Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson. And if you're one of our patrons, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. And if you're not yet a patron but would like to get our ad-free extended versions or listen and interact with us live, head to patreon.com/UK Tech and get instant access to our entire back catalogue of extended shows. And thank you to Gavin Driver, Liam Daly and Paul Middleton, three of our most recent patrons joining us, helping us finish this month with one more than we did last month. You guys are brilliant. Thank you. Ian is away this week, and we've got a bit of a treat. We're joined by a new co-host, long time media and TV producer, host of the show Me The Way podcast, and a very dear friend of mine. It's Naomi Kerbel.
Hello, hello.
Did you like that intro? Was that?
Yeah,
did
I hit really like that. I mean, a few stumbles, but
yeah, it was along the lines.
You see, in my podcast, I go back and re-edit. So I'm seeing now how the pro really does it.
Yeah, I mean, the stumble is trying not to say all the time, and I think if you can crack that, you've basically got half of broadcasting down. But we're not going to change the format of the show. It's exactly the same, just with a fresh voice for your ears. But we're going to start by jumping into this week's news. And we're starting, in fact, with news that the BBC and ITV, who, as you will know, already have a streaming service for people who want to binge on things like Broadchurch, which I recently heard of, Jonathan Creek, which I'm intimately familiar with, Coronation Street and Doctor Who and things like that. But up until now, it's exclusively been available in the US and Canada. That, however, is about to change. ITV recently confirmed that talks are concluding about launching this in Britain. BBC Director General Tony Hall, in fact, said it'll include old favourites, new releases, as well as brand new commissions. It's expected to launch in the second half of this year, and they say it will be priced competitively. Now, before we move on, just a quick question, Naomi. Do you subscribe to Netflix?
I subscribe to them all, so I'm Netflix, Sky, Amazon.
Right,
so not Apple, not Hulu.
You've got the full bag. And this is one of the things that interests me, is that we've got so many of these streaming services now that when I hear rumors of a new one, even though it sounds really compelling, I'm a big fan of British TV, I kind of feel I'm getting to the point of having a one-in, one-out policy.
I'm with you. I read this story and I was surprised. I mean, I'm thrilled with the fact that they're already doing quite well globally, particularly in North America. And maybe we'll come on to that in a minute. But I do feel at the moment like I am trying to sift through all of my different ones. I'm not actually getting to all of them all the time. So I will watch a bit of Sky to maybe get Catastrophe, Netflix to get a bit of Ozark, Broadchurch, I have to say, I totally binged on Olivia Colman. I'm a big, big fan. So that
Oscar-winning Olivia Colman
and David Tennant. That was an amazing series. But I just don't know that we need any more in this market.
Well, I mean, there's some evidence, at least, that BritBox, what it's offering, is actually onto something. It's got apparently now more than 500,000 people in North America subscribed to it, 500,000 people. And given the competition in the US alone for on-demand content, I think that's pretty promising. They've got certainly no fewer services than we have in terms of competing for our streaming dollars and pounds. But the difference, I think, is that trying to find Mrs. Marple, which I'd never heard of, but apparently is enormous here, on Hulu or something, you know.
You never heard of Mrs. Marple?
No. Is she a nurse?
She's a detective, and she's like as big as Jessica Fletcher.
Who's Jessica Fletcher?
Murder, She Wrote.
Oh, no, you know what? My detective series began and end with Hetty Wainthrop Investigates.
Okay, fine. All right. Know,
starring Patricia Routledge, okay. The classic Keeping Up Appearances lady. No, I never heard of it, but I assumed it's intrinsically British and therefore, you know, in the US would be quite popular for that reason, as a lot of those sorts of shows are. But in Britain, we know that if we want Doctor Who, we go to iPlayer. If we want Coronation Street, we go to ITV Hub. If we want First Dates or something, we go to 4OD. That's very clear, and most of those are ad-supported, or we're paying for them with our license fee, so it doesn't feel like we're necessarily having to choose one or the other. We just go where we want. But bringing BritBox here, I wonder whether that slightly confuses the marketplace and whether there's a place for it. And my personal view is that there is a place, and I would love to subscribe to it and binge on 1980s sitcoms. But I think it really has to, the way they have to present it is going to have to be unique enough that it doesn't feel like it's cannibalizing those catch-up services, but also simultaneously doesn't look like a Netflix rival. Because I don't think this is a Netflix rival. I think this is complementary, or should be complementary to Netflix.
Except that they do say that they're going to be doing their own shows, which I think is fantastic for independent production companies that are trying to find outlets. I wonder whether it's going to create a space for aggregators, like a kind of, like Sky actually is, because 4OD and the ITV Hub, it all comes under the Sky banner. So when you go to search within your Sky box for all of these things, I didn't realise, for example, First Dates, which I do binge on, was under 4OD. I just enter First Dates into my Sky search and I get it all there. So I wonder whether there will be other companies out there who will become aggregators of all of these things, and there will be apps created for that.
That's a very interesting thought, and you're probably right. And also about the commissions, I mean, one of the reasons that I think Netflix has been able to spend such huge amounts of money on original content is because it has a global subscriber base. You know, I always sort of wonder, imagine if the BBC made content in the same way as it does for Britain for the entire world, what would that do to change its mandate or the size of the budgets it has? Maybe if BritBox is able to take a lot of the money that it's getting from Europe, from UK, from US and Canada, what could it do with that? And you're right, maybe we could see, I mean, we're not going to see the likes of Amazon spending $250 million or something per episode on this new Lord of the Rings, but it might be able to stretch to some better CGI in, I don't know, Doctor Who.
Possibly. And I wonder whether companies like Alibaba or Amazon that already aggregate products will become the aggregators of this kind of content.
Yeah. Well, the question would remain, of course, you know, what would we pay for and what would we pay extra for? For me, I'm always going to be happy paying for quality. I've recently found myself buying a lot more films from the iTunes store because they're in 4K, and I bought a 4K TV. I have an Apple TV 4K. And so I could definitely see a big 4K offering. And we do produce a lot of content now in 4K, but we struggle to get access to it. And permanent downloads being somehow baked into this, I could also see as being quite attractive as an alternative to Netflix and the like. But let us know your thoughts. hello@techpodcast.uk. This will launch towards the end of the year. It'd be very interesting to hear your views of what you would pay for without having to give up an existing subscription. Well, this month marks the anniversary of the publishing of revelations about Cambridge Analytica, and more broadly, what some people saw as the end of the line for Facebook's trustworthiness as a global communications platform. A few days ago, Mark Zuckerberg and his PR team went out to preempt the inevitable press coverage of the Analytica anniversary by publishing a 3,200-word blog post outlining the future of Facebook as a privacy-focused platform, not an open and connected one. The CEO said that private messaging and small groups and ephemeral, that's your self-deleting, think Snapchat-type posts, were the fastest growing areas of online communication. That private small niche group, which I can definitely relate to as a big WhatsApp user and almost seldom Facebook user. Now, the blog came weeks after it also emerged that Facebook had planned or has plans to integrate the messaging services of WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook Messenger into one big encrypted system so you could communicate securely across all three. And he reiterated a commitment to deliver end-to-end encryption across those three platforms. Now, there are three ways that I look at this. One, and this is on the most cynical side, is that it's not simply It's basically not possible to trust what Facebook says, because Facebook knows even something as catastrophic as the Cambridge Analytica scandal, the worldwide condemnation by governments that came with it, accusations of playing a major role in election rigging, and obviously a woeful approach to privacy only temporarily impacts the business. You can tell from two metrics as well. Prices of its shares on the stock market have more than recovered since its massive fall last year, and its user base is bigger than ever. Essentially, it can say what it wants as part of a PR campaign to counter bad press like the Analytica stuff, because no one really cares and it can carry on as it wants. That's my most cynical thought on this. The second way I look at this is slightly less cynical, but nonetheless critical, which is that 99% of Facebook's revenue comes from advertising. 99%, basically all of it. So the only thing that makes Facebook's advertising model work is the use of data it holds about its users. And let's not forget, it is entirely possible, and has been proven so, to set up ads that specifically target one single person. Like, literally, you can buy an ad that only one individual is ever going to see. And Facebook may very well want to change its public-facing business, but as long as it's making all its money from the data that it holds on us, you can all but guarantee it's not going to change anything but that materially affects its ability to do that. And just before I get off my soapbox, I'm going to throw Facebook a bone here and throw my third and final way in the mix, which is, if you look at a company like Apple, for example, its profits used to come just from selling computers. That's all it did. Then in its second era, if you like, it all became about the iPhone, a product that now accounts for 2/3 of all the money the company makes. Such was the popularity of the iPhone, as well as things like the iPod, of course. It even changed its name, if you remember, Naomi, from Apple Computer Inc. to just Apple Inc. That was just, you know, over a decade ago now. And so now it's in this third era where iPhone sales are falling, but Apple's reinventing itself as a services company. It's got Apple Music, iCloud, the App Store driving all these, this increasingly large percentage of its cash. And so it's not unthinkable that Facebook could start to try and do the same, to the extent that in 10 years we'll be paying to use it as in some kind of ad-free service that sells physical products. And let's not forget, you look at a company like Nokia. Back when it was founded in the 1800s, it was running pulping mills. It produced rubber products. It even made toilet paper at one point. And yet by the mid-2000s, it pivoted several times and became the world's biggest maker of mobile phones. So it can be done. My hunch, Naomi, and this is why I'm going to finally let you actually in and have an opinion, is that unless Mark Zuckerberg leaves and the entire management structure is overhauled, the reality in my head is going to be somewhere between very cynical scenario one and slightly less cynical scenario two.
I would love to come in with a really contrarian view here, but I'm afraid I'm with you. First of all, I'd like to make the comment that a 3,200-word blog?
Yeah.
I mean, that is not a blog to me.
No, it's a novella.
It is a novella. It's probably my final dissertation for my journalism master's. So I think that, as you say, an overhaul will probably be needed. There was a speech, I think, that Sheryl Sandberg recently gave at the DLD conference in Munich. The feedback that I heard from that was that everything coming out from her is very robotic. She's not listening. She's not interacting. Contrast that with a speech that she'd given a few years before where she was so interactive with the people in the room. And I think that that is endemic of the company as a whole. There doesn't seem to be, as you say, it's an ad. It's getting 99% of its revenues from ads. And I'm with you. I'm using WhatsApp. I'm just not. I was thinking the other day, I can't remember the last time I went onto Facebook.
No, me neither. It's very, very rare. I actually deactivated my account for a little while. And the only reason I reactivated it was because I needed a link to a blog post that I'd posted on Facebook for a specific reason on Facebook a year earlier. I needed to share the text with someone, so I had to reactivate the account in order to get the text. And I haven't since deactivated it, but I also don't really use it.
For me, it's friends saying that they've had a baby, and then I copy and paste that into my contact section because I'm super organized and write the date of the baby's birth and then make sure to send them a card.
That's very manual. That's
I'm very manual.
That's quite
old, but I do it all within my iPhone. I don't have a paper diary for that. So
okay, so you're sort of half manual, semi-automatic. You are the AK-47 of social media. But you're right with Sheryl Sandberg. I mean, you know, she is Mark Zuckerberg's right-hand woman. In my head, she is similar to the role that Eric Schmidt played when Google started getting too big for its founders' boots, Larry and Sergey, and sort of came in to be the parent to keep an eye on the kids that were running the show. And Sheryl comes in with that outside view. But I think as the scandals have gone on and the need to be on message has increased, perhaps she has become more robotic. I mean, some people have said that he needs to go, she needs to go, the board needs to change, and it just needs to be an entirely new type of company. And as long as Mark Zuckerberg is at the helm and calling all the shots, then it fundamentally can't change as a business. But we have seen it done before. I do wonder whether it can be done again. Now, do you think there's a need as well, as while we're talking about this, to merge those three apps or interconnect them? Because I was trying to think what benefit that would give me, because right now Messenger and WhatsApp are basically the same product, functionally speaking. WhatsApp, I know they kind of want to make slightly more business facing, but I've heard them say that about Messenger as well. And Instagram is very, very visual, but is increasingly becoming so much more diverse that it kind of risks losing some of its identity.
I don't know how you feel about this. In terms of my podcast, I know that I'm getting most of my messages through Instagram. So if I'm thinking, oh, I vaguely remember I got a message about something, if I remember it's podcast related, then I'll go to Instagram. WhatsApp, I do loads of my work on the day job through WhatsApp now. And Facebook, as I said, I just don't use. I don't know about combining them all. I mean, maybe it make it easy. I'm just not sure.
I mean, the bigger overarching question here, of course, though, is can we ever trust Facebook? One of the things that I did quote unquote like about Zuckerberg's post is that he acknowledged that the company isn't exactly known for its trustworthiness. And I think that's a bit of an understatement. But I also think that the vast majority of people don't care. And so what is the real need? And is the need to change the business model to appease regulators, the media, and the most vocal critics? Or is it because something fundamentally doesn't work about Facebook? And the sad thing is, Facebook does fundamentally work. It makes billions in profit. It's incredibly successful. It's got a third of the world's population using it. Like, that's pretty much a benchmark for success right there. So the only need to change it would be to silence critics. And I think that they are valuable critics. But
do you not think that, a bit like Leveson, there will come a stage where something major will happen? And it has already with Cambridge Analytica, but there will be something that really taps into people's the enragement factor.
I think we've seen it. I mean, honestly, I can't think of much more than the lax handling of personal data, alleged role in election rigging, whether that's the referendum, whether it's Russia meddling, whether it's presidential campaign.
But as you say,
it
still hasn't impacted the share price.
I mean, it did temporarily. It dropped massively, but then it recovered a little bit later. So it's kind of like, well, investors don't care. The user numbers are higher than ever. We haven't seen a rival come across and steal the limelight like we had in previous years. Facebook took over from MySpace. MySpace took over from Friendster, wasn't it? We saw that cycle going. Nothing's happened with Facebook because Facebook's become like this weird AOL-esque monolith where it sort of is its own meta web. You can basically go to Facebook and do nothing but Facebook, and the only thing it needs to do is sell internet access, and then you've basically got yourself the new AOL. But we all know what happened there. This week, Reuters wrote that major British banks have committed to narrowing the gap in funding between female and male entrepreneurs after a government-commissioned report found a lack of available capital for women as holding the UK back. The report concluded that only 6% of women in Britain run their own businesses, which may or may not sound like a lot, but when you compare it to Canada, which has about 15% and almost 11% in the United States, you see that we are sorely behind our North American friends. The report also said that access to funding was the biggest barrier for female entrepreneurs. Now, Royal Bank of Scotland, that's RBS, and Lloyds, are among the first lenders who have pledged to take some action on this, again, according to Reuters, which includes publishing data on the investment disparity between female and male-led businesses under a new voluntary code. And other findings that I noticed in this report included that businesses that are run by women are on average half the value of male-led firms, and that closing the gap between women and men could add an additional $250 billion to the British economy. This is all fascinating stuff. It was actually authored by a woman called Alison Rose. She's the deputy CEO of NatWest, so she knows what she's talking about. And she set out a number of of other recommendations, including greater transparency in funding given to women-run businesses by investors and more courses teaching entrepreneurship in schools and colleges. Naomi, you flagged this topic. It's one that semi-passed me by, largely because there was a lot of very interesting stories that landed on International Women's Day on Friday. This was one of a number of those great pieces, but you you flagged this. What stood out to you about this?
I think it's surprising numbers, and it's surprising when you consider that, according to McKinsey, gender diverse companies outperform by around 15%, and it's something like 25-30% when you add racially diverse companies. So it seems to make business sense, but I think we are still struggling with pipeline. You know, in sports, we get hold of young talent as early as, you know, 5, 6, 7. You've got football training camps to spot talent. I think it's more difficult in academic subjects, but I think that it is so essential to really think about pipeline, because we can't be just saying to companies, you need to be hiring more women if there aren't more women around. I think if you just look at some of the figures out at the moment, girls studying STEM, so that's science, technology, engineering and medicine, mathematics.
I mean, that includes medicine.
Mathematics. Post GCSE is 35%, but that drops down to 25% for undergrads. And then when you get into how many are STEM professionals, it's around 23%. So we see these numbers decline. I personally think it's a lot to do with role models. It's about hearing people's stories. And I think that's really fundamental. There's Sherry Kutu's organisation, and I think, you know, you're quite familiar with them. Founders for Schools identifies role models to go into schools to share their stories. I think that's really important. They had a report out on the same day saying that 83% of deals that UK venture capitalists made last year had no women on the founding teams.
Wow.
No women, 83%. I mean, it's huge numbers. So we really are facing a crisis. But as I say, it's got to start so much earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I should say, I suppose, for full disclosure, I do know Sherry Kutu personally, and I am a member of Founders for Schools, and have given talks as part of that. But it's not profit, and I don't get paid. But I think you're right. I mean, I talk to a lot of, you know, founders and VCs and partners and people, and a lot of them are women. But the sort of overarching problem that I hear happens in the boardroom of an investment body, whether that's VC or a bank, and that it is predominantly a woman going in and sitting in front of a panel of men. And that is both, I'm told, I've never experienced this personally, that is, I'm told, daunting to prepare for, but also, you know, a very challenging situation to be in at the time. And so there's that kind of mental stigma. I don't want to say it's like self-selecting, like, oh, that's too difficult. But that's definitely what I hear over and over again from people, is that is key. And that strikes me as tapping in exactly into what Alison writes in her report, which is that access to funding was the biggest barrier. So it might not be that the funding isn't there, but actually being able to get, you know, get into that room and perform well enough in that room is part of the issue and needs to be tackled in some way.
I think coming from a background of privilege of sorts, you know, if you've made it through into higher education, you're already in a better position to handle those scenarios. And then, you know, if you make it into that room and you're a woman, there are so many things along the way that are going to knock you back a little bit. Add into that, if you are racially diverse as well, and you walk into a room and it's all white men or white men and women. So there's intersectionality there as well. So yeah, I think it's really challenging, but it's great what they're doing. This is a good start. More please.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. We should have Ian back next week. We had a great email come in from Russ as well, one of our patrons who was commenting on Ian's comments around docking a phone to a desktop into a monitor. So we're going to come to that when Ian's back, because I know it was Ian that had a lot of views on that. But thank you also to our patrons supporting us every week at patreon.com/UK Tech. It's keeping the show alive. It's keeping us excited. It's really also keeping us in the ability to buy new microphones. But also thank you to everyone listening on our free feed. You are just as valuable in a completely different way, because without the thousands of you listening, other people don't hear about the show and don't leave us reviews in iTunes. So in whatever way you're able to support or are supporting the show, thank you, thank you, thank you. It means the world, honestly. And thank you additionally to Naomi for being here this week. We'll have to get you back. I've enjoyed this greatly.
So have I. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, now you do a podcast. I mean, you know that, but people listening may not. So why don't you tell them what your podcast focuses on?
Thank you. Yeah, my podcast is called Show Me the Way. Show Me the Way. Show Me Pod. And it is a series of conversations with women at the top of their game about what it really takes to get there. So we speak to a really diverse range of people, from Eleanor Barker, the Olympic gold medal cyclist, through to ballet dancers, through to CEOs of companies. Our next one actually is with Stephanie Elise, who is the founder and chief pleasure officer, yes, that's an official title, of Mystery Vibe.
I've met her. She and I and my friend Lexi met her at Web Summit in November. And yes, we looked through their products. We spent a good hour or so with her. She's a fascinating woman, actually. I didn't realise she was on your show.
She's coming up, the next one. She runs Mystery Vibe, which is a personalisable vibrator company.
Yeah. And very interesting products they are too, I have to say. And if you're a man, I would point out, it's worth a look for curiosity, if nothing else. Yep. But there's some very, very interesting designs going on there. Well, I'm going to look out for that.
Yeah, sex then. Tech.
Sex tech.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. Yeah, we've got a whole host of, we've got career coaches, we've got all sorts of people. I would urge you to have a listen. Show Me the Way.
Absolutely. I would strongly encourage that too, having heard the previous episodes. And we'll be back with you, all being well, in a week's time. Bye, guys.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.